So the question is, can you, at this moment, be aware not only of all the things that are taking place right here, externally and internally, but can you also be aware of yourself as the awareness in which these things happen, which is not a thought, nothing to do with thinking. It's a sensing of an aliveness in the background, of things happening in the foreground. And when I say things happening, that includes thoughts, thinking. Thinking happens in the foreground. But when you are aware of the background as your very own presence, I say your own because it is essentially who you are. It is being. It is the I am, which is timeless. The timeless sense of being in the background. I am, being. I am and being are the same word. To be, I am. First person singular of the verb to be, I am. It is being. Can you sense the very being that you are, and on that level you are one with all beings? This is the level of non-differentiation. And it is that level from where true love comes, true compassion comes. Only when you can feel yourself as the underlying I am presence. Now. You can only do it now. Because it is now. It is the now in essence. So you are, that's where freedom lies. Freedom from conditions. Conditions will carry on, coming and going, some good, some bad. And that's also where creativity comes in, because through that, the very intelligence that is the I am may manifest through you. That secondary thing. What it manifests, I don't know. It varies from person to person. What does not vary from person to person is that which underlies the person. That is where the oneness is of all beings. And from there, when you sense that, you can look at a forest and sense, if you go to an ancient forest, and sense the sacredness of the forest in yourself, the very presence that you are, you feel is the very same beingness that is the life in the trees. You feel the life, the one life, because you are the one life. And in whatever manifestation you see the one life, it manifests in billions of forms. In whatever manifestation you see the one life, you recognize it as yourself. And only then can you sense the essence of the forest, or the essence of an animal, or the essence of another human being. And only then is there true connection, and more than connection, a realization of oneness. And it's only then that humans are no longer compelled to fight each other continuously. That's the madness. If you're cut off from that, everything is alien to you. Everything is other, because you only have the form. So there can be no love, there can be no empathy, there no compassion, no softness. And when you look at a forest, you say, how much does it cost? If we cut all the trees, what will we get? You can't see anything else. Forgive them, for they know not what they do. They don't know who they are. That's why they don't know what they do. So that is the fundamental dysfunction in humans, and it's fine. That too is part of the evolution of human consciousness. The shift in consciousness that is happening is a movement from predominantly thinking human beings to predominantly aware human beings. For several thousand years, humans have been completely identified with the movement of think, of thought. That's how the ego came into being. Alienation, separation, all illusions come into being. Since it happened, it was a necessary stage in the evolution, and we are coming to the end of that stage. Because thinking keeps you trapped in form, because every thought is a thought form. And most human beings are compulsive thinkers, because their sense of identity is derived from the movement of thought. They cannot let go of thinking, because to them it would be equivalent to dying. Who am I if I do not keep reminding myself of myself and my story and my life? My life. It's my life. That's a big, it's a huge illusion, just those two words. How can you? Do I have life? Then there's life and there's me. If I have life, there's life and me, and I could lose it, and then all that's left is me. No, that can't be right. I have life. That's what people think. They have a life. But of course, it's an illusion created by thought. They're separating themselves from life and say, this is life and that's me. I am life. There's no life apart from I. So since I am life, how can I lose life? I am a temporary expression in this form, fleeting, of the one formless life. So thinking is compulsive for most humans, and it is an addiction. The great addiction, much greater than drugs, is the addiction to thinking. Most of which is not only unnecessary, but represents an enormous burden and heaviness in your life. So all of you who are still here are ready to make that shift, which for most people is gradual, for very few it's sudden, the shift from continuously having to think to experiencing gaps in the stream of thinking. And not, I'm not talking necessarily about when you're meditating. Meditation is wonderful for those who feel drawn to meditation. Not everybody may feel drawn to meditation. Main spiritual practice is daily life, even for meditators. No matter how good you are at meditation, 3 hours a day, 4 hours a day, don't need to move. Even the Buddhist monks are impressed when you can sit for 2 hours. Some Westerners have enormous willpower. Of course, that's not true meditation, but true meditation is, of course, wonderful. But the main spiritual practice is daily life, as you go about your daily life. And it is there where you experiment with meeting situations rather than through thinking, through awareness. Which means there are periods in your life when you're doing things without the movement of thought that accompanies either what commenting on what you're doing or experiencing, or some completely different matter. While you're doing this, you're thinking about that. There are moments when you can move across the room, go to the bathroom, open the door, go to the wash basin, wash your hands, dry your hands, and not a single thought has crossed your mind. But you were not lost. You were present with every movement, but it happened in a field of stillness. And if that's too long, then less. Putting some honey in the tea. No thought. And the spoon goes back in the saucer. Or you stir. And while you stir your tea, there's a clear space of awareness. Why do you have to fill that with some kind of thinking? It's not profitable. It doesn't help you in any way. If there is something that you need to apply thought to, then you apply thought. But there's a vast amount of things that actually you can tackle and be with much greater intelligence if you do not apply thought, but you apply awareness. Awareness means you look at a situation. There's a misconception about what intelligence is, because we equate intelligence with the movement of thought and the ability to, through thought, dissect situations, analyze, label it, remember the labels, see how labels are related to other labels, and so on. There is a deeper intelligence out of which all creativity comes, which is non-conceptual. And that in our educational system is completely unrecognized. There are many children at school who would operate wonderfully on the non-conceptual level, and they are called slow or even stupid because they do not have a highly developed conceptual intelligence. They have a deeper intelligence. That is where creativity comes from. Albert Einstein, after graduating, was the only person in his class who couldn't get a job. He was a bit slow. Of course, to be deep, you have to be slow. But in this, in our civilization, everything is far. What's the answer to this? What's that? What's that? Quick, give me the answer. So you remain on the surface. You dance around on the surface of life. You never go any... To go deeper, you have to come still for a moment, and there's an awareness, and you look at a situation. And then, if something needs to be said or done, the words come, but they come from a deeper level. Every therapist who is effective, or anybody who works with people, you can only be effective if you come from awareness, if you bring awareness, it is not through thought. It's miraculous, even the most conceptual schools of therapy, let's say you're a psychoanalyst, you learn a lot of stuff about the human mind and you apply it. And often those psychoanalysts who become effective after 10 or 15 or 20 years, they suddenly get tired of applying their, continuously applying what they have learned, and they're simply with the patient in a space of awareness. So it is our practice, as much as possible, think when you have to think and see if you can be free of thinking as much as possible in your daily life, which is in many, many situations. And, of course, one thing that helps enormously in being free of thinking is to say yes to the present moment, because a lot of the compulsion to think arises out of the denial of what is. And so through thought, you want to destroy or run away from, you judge the present moment, you run to get away from it, you create fantasy world so that you get away from this, and so on. So that's already a great help, as that primordial practice that I described, becoming one with what is, so that you are the space, and the space is thoughtless. The space is awareness. This is the rising level of consciousness in you. So you have, on the surface, the mind-created me. And then you have something coming up from underneath, pushing, which is awareness. The new consciousness wants to come through. Sometimes it comes through the gaps in this thinking stream. Ah. And suddenly you feel more life. There's a peace, but an alive peace, alert, unburdened by the little me and its problems. Don't carry that around anymore. So your practice, when you're on the bus, in the tube, walking from here to there, doing this or that, just aware, but not thinking. And it doesn't matter how long. The length doesn't matter. The frequency is more important. How often you allow a gap in the stream of thinking. And the gap doesn't need to be long. Just shh. And so you become, it's like the density of mind lessens because gaps are appearing in the mind. And so you become actually more intelligent. We can call it, that's a title by a book by Krishnamurti, The Awakening of Intelligence. And really, that's what it is. True intelligence comes in, which is not the ability to solve IQ tests. That is a small aspect of intelligence, but not intelligence itself. Now, there may be some of you who are very good at IQ tests and who feel offended right now. And that's fine, because perhaps some of your identity was built on the fact that you have a very high IQ. If that's the case and you feel some inner, that can't be right, then you observe that. I don't have that problem because I have never undergone an IQ test, but I am absolutely sure the result would not be very good. My mind just doesn't work that way. Yesterday I picked up where I'm staying, my friend's house, there's a book on Sudoku. I picked it up, I looked at the simplest one at the very beginning, for 5 minutes, completely meaningless. Can't do it. And the most beautiful thing is, if you can meet other human beings, whether it's a brief encounter or a longer encounter, or especially in your relationship, predominantly through being aware rather than think, relate through awareness rather than thinking. What does that look like in practice? Somebody comes to you and says something. While you listen, there is this space. You're listening, you're bringing space to it. You're not preparing what you're going to say or commenting on what the other person is saying or thinking about something totally different or trying to get out what you want to get out and say, but simply be there as awareness, a space of awareness. And there's a clarity, and this is where a human relationship deepens. There's no depths in relationship that are completely mind-dominated. They're all thinking. And then it's so easy to get drawn into that, especially when more than two humans come together, the mind energy starts working. And you get drawn, it's like a stream that carries you along. And then he said, and then, wow, I can't believe, you know what he did then? And then, can't get out of it anymore. It's for you to represent, be there, as and bring a different dimension to human interaction. And that dimension is not some new thought. Of course, it's better to have a good thought than a bad thought. But go deeper and have no thought. And so, awareness replaces thinking. And where you still need to think, actually your thinking will be much more focused and powerful because you're not wasting the mental abilities in useless thinking. It now can become focused. So that is the practice of being free of mental noise. Be there, and when you are aware, you are not a person anymore. You are only a person when you are dominated by thought, because the person consists of thought. When you are aware, you are there as not a person, but a deeper presence. And this is what the world needs. It doesn't need more clever persons. It doesn't need for you to become more knowledgeable or even better as persons. Many persons have very good intentions. They say, I want to become a better person. Of course, that's better than wanting to become a worse person. But it doesn't quite work. Many people who are trying to be good people often do bad things and say, how could I have done that? I wanted to be a good person. And I shouted at him again. So it's not improving the person that you are, but going beyond the person. That's where the goodness, true goodness, comes through you. And then you become compassionate towards yourself also and towards the limitations of your little person. It's never going, as a person, you're not going to be perfect. There will be shortcomings, this or that. That's fine. It's form. You have your, but the non-personal dimension is coming in more and more into your life. Some people who practice certain arts or crafts can be in the space of awareness in the moment of creativity. Sportsmen sometimes, who are very good, they're not thinking while they're engaged in hitting this ball or that ball, whatever it is. There's absolute presence. The moment thought comes in, it's lost. I remember hearing an interview with the actor who fell from his horse and broke his back, and he died 2 or 3 years ago. He played Superman, and he fell from his horse, and he was saying, I lost the present moment for a moment. Some thought came in, and the horse reacted to the thought, and it threw him. He was in complete oneness with the horse until a thought interfered, and that created the accident. So when you bring awareness to a situation, you and the situation become one. There is a, and it's almost as if the solution, if there is a problem that you encounter, which is not a problem, I would say, but a challenge. Problem is mind-made and needs time. Challenge is something that's happening now and you need to do something. That's true. If there is a challenge, you look at the situation. Now, the look means more than look visually. It means awareness is brought to it. And there's the total space of that situation, the solution emerges out of the totality of the situation. And sometimes when you bring awareness to the situation, the solution may not even come through you, because you have brought the awareness, suddenly the situation solves itself. Or it becomes solved by some external agency. Very often this happens. So problems become perpetuated if you meet them through mind and react through mind. So the practice then is to be with situations, people, and initially with very simple things, so that you can practice. Smell a flower and don't say, "Oh, that smells good." Say nothing, think nothing, just be with the perception. Be the perceiving consciousness. Whenever if you use public transport, wonderful opportunity, instead of putting something on your ears that feed the mind with boom, 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 or even reading, why not practice being there as a conscious presence? Look at people. I love looking at people and seeing the many human forms, the multiplicity of the human form. I love sitting in public places or being on a bus or a tube and watch the multiplicity of the human form without any thought. You don't need to think, just watch. And you actually become a blessing in that particular place, wherever you happen to be. Because something emanates from you that is of a very different frequency than what the mind generates. And that emanates, it cannot not affect others, even if you have no actual contact through words with others. It affects the space that you are in. And that's also where true healing lies. You heal the space that is around you, but not by thinking, "I am healing you." It happens by itself. So you become a benign presence in this world, rather than a heavy person with big, heavy Now, the compulsive mind has been dominating humans for thousands of years. It's not going to go away voluntarily. It's not going to say, okay, I won't bother you anymore. It is an energy movement that wants to carry on. It has a certain momentum. And it's the momentum of millennia, of thousands of years, at least 6,000 or 7,000 years. There people differ in how they see it. Let's say it's been going for 6,000 or more years. That's long enough. And so it has a momentum. And it will overpower you, that momentum. And it's not a... That's fine. It's the human mind. You will lose yourself in it again and again. And then you wake up out of it again and again. And back you are, lost in this inner stream of thinking. If nothing else this afternoon, for many of you, perhaps even without knowing it, as you sit here, you experience moments of no thought. Just, oh. And so you take that into your daily life. If it is arising in you, otherwise it would make no sense. If you were totally identified with mind, you would get very angry saying that you don't have to think all the time. How dare... What a liberation. Something happened to me many years ago, and that's unusual in the sense that it happened very suddenly, whereas for most people it is a gradual process of becoming free when the mind kind of subsided. It created so much suffering, and something happened, something snapped, and then the mind just went, the compulsive mind. And I woke up the next morning, and everything was alive and peaceful and beautiful. Even the traffic. And I didn't know why. How can everything be so peaceful when I've spent the last few years in agony and anxiety and depression, and suddenly it's peaceful? What happened? I didn't know what happened. All I knew was suddenly everything is very alive and peaceful and beautiful. I was on top of a bus traveling along Oxford Street, because I was living in London at the time, and all the thousands of people, shoppers, everything was peaceful. They always moved about in a field of peace. Beautiful. The underground, beautiful. Northern Line, which they used to call the Misery Line. I don't know if it still is. It was beautiful, peaceful, wonderful. Just enjoyed sitting in the tube. Then, a year later, I looked at some books and visited some teachers and said, what is it all about? And one monk said to me, a Buddhist monk, what it all comes down to is really not thinking. That's Zen. And suddenly I realized, that's what happened, I'm not thinking anymore. The mind had stopped, I didn't even know that the mind had stopped. All I experienced was peace, because it comes from the being that's underneath the mind. And so I suddenly understood, oh, it's the cessation of compulsive thinking. Of course, I was still doing some thinking, but my thinking had become reduced by about 85%. So that enormous burden of mental noise had dropped away. And so I understood now what the nature of this transformation is, whereas at first I just underwent the transformation without understanding it. And now... many humans are ready now for this shift. Otherwise, there would be no point in sitting here. You would have to go to a monastery for 10, 20, for 30 years, and even then, there's no guarantee that you would get it. That was the traditional way. humanity as a whole, the readiness wasn't such that so many humans could be open to this without undergoing through arduous, no, sorry, if you've been engaged in arduous spiritual practice for the past 20 years, don't feel offended. I do not want to invalidate your spiritual practice. It all served a purpose because you're here now. But there are many who have not gone through arduous spiritual practices and are ready for it. Oh, well, that's a pity. Man says, why? I've done all this work for nothing. Maybe that's what Jesus meant as a parable about the laborers. And some laborers work all day, and then some come in the last hour, and they work just for 1 hour, and they get the same wage. So many humans are now ready for this shift, because humanity needs to go through this shift if it's not going to self-annihilate. Well, self-annihilation is fine on a psychological level, because that's what we are doing. The person begins to dissolve, but not on a physical level. Liberation is a term that is traditionally used in many traditions. Freedom, liberation, freedom from what? It's freedom from compulsive thinking, which implies freedom from time, because it's only time as we experience it is generated by compulsive thinking. It's a mind-made thing. And freedom from the false sense of self is also implied in that, because the false sense of me is mind-generated. So it's freedom from mind, is freedom from time, is freedom from self. And self, the false self, is a dreadful curse and burden on humanity to carry that weight around with you. So for a time now you are a transitional being, most of you. Some of you have already gone, you're virtually there, with perhaps occasional incursions of the old consciousness. But for many, you are a transitional being, which is a very strange thing to be, between two levels of consciousness. This is the shift. One day you're in the old, the next day you're in the new, and you shift even on one day, even in 1 hour. You're present with everything, and suddenly something comes in, pulls you back into stream of thinking. Particularly challenges, difficult humans coming into your life. And of course, let's face it, most humans are difficult. In the unenlightened state, they're very problematic. And sooner or later, when two humans come together, some conflict arises, which can only ultimately be resolved by the arising of awareness. Otherwise, this conflict will grow and proliferate. As you know, it was Ram Dass who said, if you think you're so enlightened, spend a week with your parents. But that, of course, is a big test for many people. But spend a week with anybody is a big enough test. Spend 3 days with anybody. Somebody said to me the other day that in their experience, the first 3 days when people come together on holiday or visiting others, the first 3 days are okay, but But then after on the fourth day, something happens and conflict arises. And that conflict would proliferate unless awareness dissolves it again. It will proliferate. And many friendships have ended when people went together on holiday. And if any of you have lived in communes, communal living, then you know how difficult, how challenging that is. It's a wonderful challenge if it's used rightly, but then you see how hard it is to live with humans in a space together. I lived in a community once or twice, and it was already easy because I had already embraced surrender. But otherwise, if I hadn't, it would have been dreadful. Some humans are very unpredictable. There's the mood swings that come through, whether what kind of mind stream they happen to be occupied by, are enormous. There were some people in the community. Often I was sitting at breakfast and I could hear somebody coming down the stairs. And you never knew who would be coming. I knew who that person was, but what mood was in it could be an angelic mood or monstrous mood. You never knew who was going to come down the stairs on that particular day. And all that had to be received in the space of aware presence, in which many dysfunctions actually dissolved, even in others. So you dissolve conflict. You dissolve dissonance simply by not by doing anything, never by feeling I am dissolving it, simply by being the presence, by being there as presence. When you watch the news, it's easy to be reactive, of course, when you see certain politicians on the screen, it's easy to go, he's such an idiot, shocker, maybe so unconscious. But even there, you can just be there and see it and be there as... And perhaps this would even affect the world situation, although you're only watching it on the screen. You cannot not affect others. Your state of consciousness affects others. Whoever has even the slightest arising awareness will be helped by the awareness that arises through you. I don't call it your awareness. There's only one awareness. It arises through you. No thought. So now this is not to be confused with falling below thought, which is one way of escaping the dilemma of the human mind. Drugs will do that for you, some drugs, alcohol will do that for you, some entertainment will do it for you, or if you're getting very tired, you fall below thought and you feel a bit better because you're not tortured by the mind. Feel a bit more alive now. And the next step is then unconsciousness. This is not the way we are going when I say go beyond thinking. You can fall below thinking, or you can rise above thinking. We are rising above thinking, and when you rise above thinking, there's an alertness and a presence compared to which thinking is a dreamlike state. Compulsive thinking is like a dream. This is why traditionally many spiritual traditions use the term awakening. You awaken out of incessant compulsive thinking and a me created by thinking. So we rise above thinking. It is sometimes the case that when you rise above thinking, you're there for a while, and suddenly there's a pull and you go straight through the level of thinking where the humans into below thinking. Meditators know this. They're meditating, perhaps they're free of thinking, and before they know it, they've fallen asleep. So you were above thinking and very quickly you go... And I've seen Buddhist monks, especially in the early morning meditation at 4:30, going like... Daily life is our practice. Now it is possible that some questions may have arisen in some of you concerning the transformation. Now, you're welcome to ask. There are microphones, but before you do, first of all, the essence does not lie in any answer to any question. The essence is already here. So whether your question gets answered or not is secondary. There are different types of questions. Some questions are helpful. They are alive. Other questions are simply produced by the human mind. And if possible, ask questions that are alive rather than questions like, how does your teaching relate to the doctrine of this or that in the Buddhist school of this and that? Or, what did you have for breakfast this morning? If it's a vital question, it's helpful to everybody. That's always the case.
I'm interested in, with children, when would you start talking about the power of now, and how would you do that, especially if you feel that the child is very conceptual and perhaps not a future Einstein, as you mentioned before?
Okay. Thank you. Nowadays, many children, because of all the entertainment, the media, the video games, and so on, their mind gets stimulated into conceptual thinking at a very early age. And they lose touch with the depths of their being. They're completely in the mind. And then they lose themselves in the screen. They play this game. And all the energy flows out, completely cut off from the rest of their body, cut off from nature. A dreadful thing for children not to be in contact with nature. If they have a dog, at least that's something. But to be totally devoid of contact with nature and live in an artificial man-made environment is dreadful for their development. So the question is important. First of all, it's the essence in bringing children to this consciousness, and they have it innately, it's still there in the child. Even in a modern child, it's perhaps less covered up than in an adult. However, the main way to teach a child is the way in which you lead your life. It's how you bring awareness into situations when you talk to the child. How do you listen to your child? First question. When the child speaks to you, are you there as a thinking entity, reactive thinking, or are you there as an aware presence that is simply completely... Aware presence is open, and you take in the words of the child. There comes the first teaching. You're not saying anything, but you're teaching by being present. You teach by being aware. So how you act in the world, at home, how you interact with your partner and with the child or the other children, that is an essential part of the teaching already, before we even come to the point of what you can do actively to show your child. First, it's so when children, sometimes you'll hear little children cursing already, where do they learn this? At home. Or they get into temper tantrums. Well, probably the parents do, and so they learn it. So the way you are at home is the main teaching. That will already transmit itself. Then in addition to that, it's essential to bring the child to nature. A very young child will be very inquisitive because the mind needs to absorb labels and concepts. That's a necessary stage. So there's a stage where the child asks, what's this? What's that? What's that? That's a critical stage. Yes, the child needs the label. That's such and such a bird, that's a tree, that's that. But the moment the child is given a label, the label has also become a barrier. It's not when the child hears the name of the bird, somebody said it, I don't know, it might have been Krishnamurti. When you give the name of the bird to the child will never see that bird again. That's putting it strongly, in strong terms, because it will now relate mainly to the bird through the label of whatever the bird is called, or whatever it is. So you have to be careful when you transmit language to the child, that the child does not become imprisoned in concepts and language. So one way of avoiding is, for example, it's a simple way of saying, I just, what's this? You don't say, this is a bird. You say, we call it bird. We call it an oak tree. And then instead of leaving it at that, you take the child's attention directly to the thing and say, look at it. Touch. Look. See that? And bring in spaces where the child is just looking and interacting without the concepts. So that the child's mind does not become dominated by concepts. Keep the reality. Look, listen, there. You point the child's attention away from the conceptual world so that the child stays in touch with the tangible, can still perceive directly instead of through concepts. So don't get trapped in concepts. Again, in some alternative schools, they are reluctant to teach a child to read and write too soon, and I think they're very wise. Let the child experience first the world before you bring in all that. So that's one way of teaching the child, and then come other ways of teaching. Bring the child's attention to breathing, bring in little gaps in the child's, simply by pointing out attention, be it, look, can you listen? Listen to the silence. Listen to this pain body. Most children also have pain bodies. And I recommend in A New Earth, I talk about how to bring a child's attention to the child's emotional field so that the child isn't, so that an awareness grows of the emotional fluctuations in the child. So in case of the child's pain body, I recommend that you, after a pain body attack, you say to the child, yesterday when you had the temper tantrum, how did you feel then? What was that? What does it feel like when it comes up? Does it have a color? What would it look like? You find your own words. The essence of what I'm saying is, bring the child's awareness to it so that the child, there's a beginning awareness rather than an identification with it. But always, whatever you do, your main teaching is yourself. not what you say or do to the child. That's, if you embody awareness at home, the child will absorb that. Of course, you will have to counteract the enormous influence of the culture, a mad culture to a large extent, the school and so on and so on. Also not realize the child has, don't react to whatever, whether the child is doing well at school or not is secondary. So you, some teachers are bringing it in, that's a good thing, but they are up against the educational establishment, so it's, but some are bringing it in without making it an official part of the curriculum. They just bring in presence, and they teach the children presence, to be present with their mind and so on. So don't let the children get lost in a world of concepts. But first, of course, you will have to step out of the world of concepts yourself, the religion, everybody's religion. Thank you.
Can you hear me? Yeah, I just wanted to ask, how do you deal with grief? I'm just going through, I lost my mother, you know, not long ago, and it's very painful, you know?
Yes.
Just wanted to know what is your kind of, you know, what would be the way, you know, about to deal with this
yes.
loss.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Acceptance can be at two levels. One is the acceptance of, let's say, of death of a loved one. But that's very hard for most people to accept death immediately as it happens. It's very hard. So if you cannot accept that somebody has just passed away, and it is a very strange thing, somebody that has been part of your life for 40, 50, a parent. Both my parents passed away last year. My mother in August and my father in November. It's strange, they didn't even live together. So I also became acquainted with that. Grief arises as a natural thing when somebody close to you passes away, and you meet grief with acceptance. Rather than thinking, I must become free of grief, experience and accept that this is what you feel. But if possible, don't let it go into your mind so much, but put attention on what you feel. If you need to weep, you weep. So rather than trying to get away from it, you embrace the grief, but you don't feed it. So there's a difference between allowing it and embracing it and feeding it with your mind. So your mind may have stories about the past that you spent with that person, or how unfair it is and how dreadful it is, or that you are now alone, or whatever the mind creates, and that would feed the grief. But if you can take it helps if you've practiced being in the body, you can easily take your attention into an emotion, and you are with that emotion, and whether it is grief or whether it is some other emotion like fear, which is many people are familiar with, and some people, many are familiar with fear on a daily basis, almost everybody. Rather than thinking, how can I become free of grief? How can I become free of fear? No. Fear is there. Feel it and allow it to be there because it is what is at this moment. Through completely allowing it as it is, another dimension arises very slowly, and that's very hard to describe what that dimension is, but the word that I use is there's space around the grief. When you allow the grief, suddenly you notice there's grief and there's a certain spaciousness there. This comes through saying yes to what is. And that spaciousness is the unconditioned that arises. And in that spaciousness, there is great peace also. When my father and my mother passed away, both instances, I wept a few times briefly. Came, and of course, as you know, grief comes in waves. Sometimes you're free for a few hours, and then another wave of grief comes, and then you have to allow that. I had a few very short waves of grief, and the rest was surrender. And when grief came, I surrendered to the grief. And when in both cases, I saw the body left behind of my mother, and later the body left behind by my father. And again, a very deep meditation. There was grief, but there was peace around and underneath it. So it's quite possible to be in the state of grief, and if you allow it, to also feel some peace beyond it. You can be weeping and yet not be totally shaken by it and still feel some peace beyond, if you completely accept the grief. And then after a while the healing sets in and peace remains. There can be great, death is always a tremendous challenge, but it's a great opportunity, whether it's your own death or somebody else's death. I love to contemplate death. Enormous revelation of deep peace I felt. There was a strange moment when my father's coffin was led. There were some men, they had ropes around it, and then they tried to lower it into the grave. And the last moment, they dropped it a few inches, and it suddenly made a thump. Boom. That moment there was grief and peace simultaneously. It seemed to be, that thump seemed to say, that's how insignificant every life really is. It was the last, that last noise was so, had such an impact on me. It was that thump was embodied the whole of impermanence of everything. But it was more than it was every cell of my body could feel that thump. And there were tears, and underneath the tears there was deep peace, because when you truly accept the fleetingness of every form, because we are all here for just a little while in this form, if you truly accept the fleetingness of form, there's always deep peace behind it. It takes you into a very deep peace. I love, for example, looking at old photos or very old films. And then I often say, look at that. For example, a scene of people, street scene in London in 1910 or whatever. I said, look at that. They're all dead now. Or you watch a film and they all look so alive, and you look at each one of these actors, they're all dissolved. They're all dissolved into nothingness. And in a few years, all of us here, we could take a photo now, and in 60, 70 years, almost everybody will be gone. Well, give you a bit more, 80 years. And in many cases, probably sooner. If we took a photo and then somebody finds the photo in an antiquarian bookseller and says, oh, look at all these people, they're all dead now. And there is, when you also have to remember that soon you'll be dead too, so it's not that tragic because we're all following very soon.
You observed in nature that after a stressful event, ducks vigorously flap their wings a few times in order to release surplus energy, thus preventing it from becoming trapped in their body and turning into negativity. How should we flap our wings, for example, after a car accident?
Okay, thank you. After a traumatic event, such as a car accident, some of the trauma may be contained in your body as a contraction. Sit down quietly and bring attention to it. Feel the contraction, feel the contracted energy that is there in the body. And again, the key is always not wanting to get rid of it, but bring a yes to it. Bring a yes to whatever it is that you're experiencing at this moment. That initiates the healing process. So for humans who don't have wings to flap anymore, the key to dissolving stuck energy in the body, no matter what caused it, is to bring attention to it and allow it to be there. And through allowing, the space is there around it. It is the space that heals it and dissolves it. So rather than you trying to heal it or dissolve it, bring the attitude of allowing it to that moment and allow the space to do the rest within you. So that applies also after you've had a fight, not necessarily a physical fight, with your partner or conflict situation with another human being. After the event, you may still feel the energy of it inside your body. And the key is to actually feel it. Otherwise, if you don't feel it, bring conscious attention to it, the energy will use your mind. So the energy movement, which is the emotional energy of the interaction, is still present in you, and it will rise into your thought processes, and it will, the inner voice, that is the thinker, will be the voice of that emotion that's left over from the fight. So the emotion will use your mind to keep itself going when you're not attentive. But if you bring attention to it directly, it cannot use your mind to keep itself going. Now, the ducks, of course, are very lucky because they don't have a mind that keeps the energy of the fight going. So all they have to do is flap their wings, and then they don't remember the fight. Certainly not as a self-reference, like, he did something to me. I won't forget that, what he did to me. I'm never going to trust him again, or whatever it is. That these are the human stories. So for ducks, it's easy. For humans, they need to bring awareness to it, which is allowing this energy to be there. Feel it. But don't, if you feel it, you don't need to think it. Think about it. Feel it, and through that, it will gradually dissolve. Whatever you bring awareness to will dissolve in the awareness. Awareness is another word for which is presence. As you know, I've wrote about it somewhere. I said it is like a fire that consumes everything. So you bring your suffering into the space of awareness rather than thinking, I shouldn't be suffering. That creates a lot of suffering. If you think, I shouldn't be suffering. But if you accept that this is what I feel at this moment, this is, and bring awareness to it, something happens. Acceptance is part of awareness. You cannot bring awareness if you don't accept it. There's a book called, it may be, I don't know whether it's a book called The Road Less Traveled, I think that's the title, The Road Less Traveled. Now that book has the first sentence that is maybe the best in any book, and if you understand that sentence, you don't need to read the rest. The first sentence says, life is difficult. And then it explains, if you accept the fact that life is difficult, it's no longer difficult. It's not literal, but this is basically the essence of what it says. But if you believe life should not be difficult, there should not be any problems, I should not have to suffer, then you suffer a lot, and it gets very difficult. But if you accept, yes, life is difficult, there is suffering that arises from time to time, this is the human condition, you accept. The transformation comes through acceptance. I never read that book. I read the first two lines and I said, that's it. Thank you. A little reminder now. You're not a person, but this is not something that you should believe in. But realize for yourself that apart from being the person, there's a deeper level to who you are, and that is consciousness or awareness. So don't return to being a little person, because every person is a little person. Even the big VIPs are little persons. Use that. Play with being a person, but don't get absorbed into being a person. Realize in your daily life that the essence of who you are is not in form, not the body that dissolves quickly, not the psychological form of me, not where you come from, your past history, or where you're hoping to go as the little me, which is only the grave, ultimately. Although the little me tries to say, no. More and more, be open to the arising awareness, so that the person loses its density. And if you are still sitting here, obviously it's already happening in you. Whether the mind says otherwise doesn't matter, because the mind cannot recognize transformation. The mind might say, nothing is happening to me, and yet it is happening. The mind cannot recognize presence. The mind, how can the mind recognize? And it's not, presence is not memorable, because presence is presence. So you can't say, I was present once. Presence, you can't remember presence as such, because it's not content, it's space. So it's not memorable. The mind relies on memory. It can remember something bad that happens much more easily. And it loves doing that, because it builds its identity around it to a great part. So it is already arising, and in humanity as a whole, and those humans who are not open to it, who do not have the transparency, unfortunately, will encounter more intense suffering. That's just how it is. Because simply because the evolutionary movement is blocked in them. So you can help them not by saying, I can help you, but by being aware. The more aware you are, the more it will... Whoever has the slightest opening will be affected by it, and not including people you don't even meet. And other times you will meet people, and if there's a slight opening, something will be mentioned, maybe just a word, and then you will say something, and they will say, what do you mean by that? And you will see suddenly their eyes open, and they wonder, what do you mean by that? And you say a few more words, and suddenly say, wow, yes. Whatever you might be saying, being in the body, being present, being aware, there's only this moment. Oh, if they're right. So you become, whether you want to or not, a teacher, but that doesn't become your identity anymore. Just as I don't have an identity as a spiritual teacher, because whenever you have you rely on a form identity, sooner or later you suffer. So the spiritual teacher, yes, teaching will come through you, through energy and through words. It's inevitable. But that doesn't mean that you now have a new identity and you see yourself as a teacher. Just as I'm not, the moment I walk away from here, this is a teaching situation, but the moment I walk away from here, there is no teacher.